One of my favorite stories in the Bible is the calling of the prophet Samuel. You probably know it. A young boy is growing up around the temple at Shiloh, a holy place that has fallen into disrepair under the poor leadership of the old priest Eli and his two bozo sons. It's a sleepy sort of place where not much ever happens. As the narrator puts it, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. One night, however, Samuel is awakened by a voice in the temple that is repeatedly calling his name. Samuel. Samuel. Assuming it's Eli calling him, he gets up and wakes the priest, who tells him he didn't call, go back to bed. A second time the voice comes, and again Samuel wakes up Eli, and again Eli tells him to go back to sleep. But when the voice comes a third time and Samuel rouses him once more, the old man finally understands what's happening, and he coaches the boy in what to say if the voice comes again. Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. That story gives me goosebumps. In a time when the word of the Lord is rare, God comes not to the powerful or the well-trained or the expected, but to a child. God calls this individual by name and says, I have a purpose for you. That's what call stories in the Bible are like. Abraham, Moses, Jeremiah, Mary. These key figures find God calling their names, summoning them to a task, saying, hey, you. Yeah, you. I have a job for you. I tend to group our reading from the book of Isaiah today in with all those other stories most of the time. The text is commonly referred to in that way as the calling of this great prophet, and it certainly has lots in common with those other stories. Heavenly messengers, an objection or two, more than a hint of fear and trembling. But I learned this week that it is different from all those other stories in one very important way. No one calls Isaiah directly. There was no quiet voice in the night saying, Isaiah, Isaiah. There was no booming voice from the heavens or crackling voice from a burning bush speaking straight to him. It's easy to miss in all the smoke and fire of this story, but Isaiah is never called in quite that way. And I do think it matters. The way Isaiah tells it, one day he found himself in the midst of an incredible vision. It's a vision so magnificent, so awe-inspiring, that it almost does him in. He finds himself in the temple, and he catches a glimpse of God. Not all of God, mind you, just a tiny bit of the edge of God's robe is enough to fill the whole massive temple. And it's enough that the scene is throbbing with energy. There are seraphs floating around, which might make you think of cute little angelic beings. But seraphs are not so sweet, actually. These are sort of like flying six-winged snakes, probably more than a little terrifying to encounter. And the song they sing is one of God's unapproachable majesty and power. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. The song of the seraphs is so loud and intense that the whole place is shaking. There's smoke all around. It sounds a little bit like a heavy metal concert to me, and Isaiah is understandably overwhelmed by it all. Everyone in ancient Israel knows that you don't see God and live to tell the tale. Even Moses, the one who spoke with God as a friend, only saw God's back in passing once. Isaiah knows he is not fit for the holiness of what he is encountering in this incredible vision. Woe is me, he says. I am lost. He's sure this is the end for him. No mere mortal is meant to see what he has just seen. At this point, one of the six-winged flying snakes comes at him with a burning coal, which again is like really the stuff of nightmares, right? But this turns out to be a gesture of purification, of forgiveness. Your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out, the creature says. Somehow Isaiah has been allowed into the grandeur and mystery of God's presence in a special way. It's okay, the seraph says. You are allowed to be here. It's an amazing scene for sure, But notice that Isaiah has not been asked to do anything. He's simply been allowed to be where he is, close to the presence of God. And then comes that question. So you know that moment in a meeting where you've had a good and productive conversation, and the group has agreed that something needs to be done. A project needs to be started, or phone calls need to be made, or helpers need to be rounded up. Everybody agrees on the plan, but nobody's yet been designated to carry it out. And so the chairperson says, okay, who's going to do this? It's the moment when everybody looks down at the papers in front of them and sort of shuffles them around, or rummages around in their bags for their cell phone. Somebody steps out to answer a call, and there's this great big awkward silence, right? Who's going to do this? Who is going to step forward? That's sort of what happens after Isaiah has just found himself forgiven in the temple. His lips are still singed from this burning coal, and he hears the divine chairperson ask that looming question, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? You get the sense that behind that question, there was maybe a meeting of some sort, with heavenly beings of all kinds gathered around a big conference table. It was agreed that the people were lost and in need of some guidance. Someone definitely needed to go and bring a word to them. And everybody nodded, yep, that's right. Someone needs to do that. And so God asks, who? There is actually a scene very much like this one in the book of 1 Kings, where the prophet Micaiah recounts having once been a spectator in the divine council, like Isaiah is right here. He heard God ask who would carry out an important mission, and one of the heavenly beings finally stepped up and agreed to go. So probably that's what everybody was expecting here as well. Everybody was probably expecting an angel of some sort to step forward when God named this need. But while they're all shuffling their papers and still hoping somebody else would volunteer, this small voice from the back pipes up. Here am I, it says. Send me. Isaiah had an important calling. Make no mistake about that. He brought all sorts of words to his people at a crucial moment in their history. Words of challenge and disorientation, comfort and hope. But no great booming voice addressed him directly and said, Isaiah, I want you to do this. Isaiah found his calling in a more ordinary way, by seeing a need and offering himself. I think maybe we should think of Isaiah as sort of the patron saint of those who show up. Here I am is a radical statement today, I think. We live in a time and culture when so much encourages us to hole up in our own spaces, our own routines, our own little worlds. Participation in associations and groups of all kinds has been trending downward in recent years as we receive the message in countless ways that life is about us and us alone. It's about entertainment and acquisition and stuff. It's not about the wider picture and the needs of the world. It is about me. To say, here am I, is to offer yourself for someone else, for something greater. It's to say, I'm not holding on to everything, all my time, all my abilities, all my resources. It's to say, I am here, and I am ready to show up for you. They may be radical words today, but they are absolutely central words for Christian faith. Life given by God, life lived with Jesus, life empowered by the Spirit is about saying, here am I, again and again. There might be big moments in our lives when we are called to speak those words. More often, I think they are meant to mark our ordinary days, all the countless ways that we can show up for others. Serving in the community, listening to another story, including someone who is left out, offering your skills where they are needed. Even something as simple as joining in a congregational assembly, or serving in coffee hour, or coming to worship and singing, lending your voice in praise, is a form of saying, here am I. John Bell reminds us that this is actually one of the core reasons why we sing at all. to offer ourselves. Something extremely rare happens when a congregation sings to its maker, he writes. For not only are there 10 or 50 or 500 individual voices giving their unique gift as they open their mouths and sing, there is also the unique blending of high and low voices, sharp and flat, sophisticated and rough-tongued, male and female, old and young. The chances are that never again will every one of these people be in exactly the same place, singing these particular hymns and songs. At the next service of worship, some will be missing, others will be new, and the likelihood is that the liturgy will require a different selection of songs for singing. So if we can but sense it, every time a congregation sings, it is offering an absolutely one-time gift to its maker. It is important that every song is offered to God with that sense of uniqueness. God is worth it. It matters immensely that you are here today, that you are part of this gathering, that your voice is part of our common and absolutely unique offering to God, that you say, "Here am I." It's possible that we might find our calling like a bolt from the blue, a voice clearly speaking our names. But perhaps more often, like Isaiah, we find our calling by simply showing up where the community needs us and discovering along the way what might be summoned forth. Friends, we worship a God who, as our next hymn says, is glorious and yet comes among us here in human time, is powerful and yet bends to us in weakness, is living and yet shows love in dying. This God is no lone divine dictator, distant and commanding and aloof. No, this God makes space for each of us and invites us to offer what we have and who we are for the purposes of the kingdom. It is an offering we are meant for. It is an offering that gives life. So we follow Isaiah, the patron saint of those who show up, saying to our Maker once more today, "Here am I. Send me." Amen.